Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, places, and events in central Iowa. It's good to get together again to provide facts to our community through Zoom technology and the spoken word. Thank you for listening. I am Pat Schlarbaum, your host for the hour with engineer Mike Murphy and good friend and neighbor and keeper of the Prairie Winds Prairie, Mike Metz. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Pat.
Hey, did you see any of the big, big moon over your prairie?
The big, big moon was a prairie moon, that was for sure, early this morning.
Yeah, and it is another jam-packed hour of news and information to get you through this 17th day of December 2021, with a full moon occurring tomorrow, Saturday night.
And the weather will be partly sunny today, similar to what yesterday was, yet not too bad for December, with a high today of 42 and an overnight low of 21. Colder over the weekend, however, high of 29 Saturday and dipping into the lower teens at 12 degrees Saturday night and a high of 35 on Sunday. But big sunshine returns Monday with a high back into the upper 40s into next Wednesday. So let's welcome Dennis Hart, who works so wonderfully at gathering the news for this week from the pages of our local newspaper.
That big storm that blasted its way through Iowa on Wednesday made the biggest news of the week in the Ames Tribune, and word of it was on the paper's website yesterday. Those storms killed at least one person and brought tornadoes and strong winds and heavy rain to the state. More than a dozen tornadoes were reported, most in the western part of Iowa. Wind gusts topped 80 miles an hour, and there were widespread power outages. And those strong winds brought smoke and dust from Kansas wildfires to the state. Yesterday, Governor Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation for 43 counties in Iowa. That means state resources can be used to help those counties recover from the effects of the storms. Now let's go back to last Friday's print edition, which reported that rumors of a violent threat at Ames High School had proven unfounded. Ames police were at the high school investigating last Thursday. Several Ames High students were said to have left school early that day after they had heard rumors of a possible threat of violence. The Trib also reported that a crush of coronavirus patients and burned-out staff had some Des Moines hospitals canceling some elective appointments. The state had earlier reported 777 coronavirus patients, just 1 week after reporting a then-record 721 patients hospitalized with the disease. Late this week, more than 800 patients were hospitalized with the virus in Iowa. Most of those hospitalized have not been vaccinated. The percentage of Iowans who were fully vaccinated was about 54%. There was also word that the Verbio plant in Nevada had started producing renewable natural gas. It became the first industrial-scale facility of its type in the United States to use agricultural residues as its feedstock. The Nevada plant had been under construction and renovation for the past 2.5 years to make it a combined renewable natural gas and ethanol production facility. It cost $35 million to make the renewable natural gas part of the plant operational. The second phase will cost $80 million to make the plant able to produce ethanol as well as additional renewable gas. The second phase is expected to be operational by late next year. There was also a story that the U.S. Department of Justice had concluded the state of Iowa has violated the legal rights of people with intellectual disabilities by housing too many of them inside institutions. Iowa continues using big institutions, such as the Glenwood and Woodward Resource Centers, at much higher rates than most other states. The report says the state should instead be finding more ways to provide care for people with intellectual disabilities in their communities. And the Trib had word that the Ames Ice Skating Club was going to hold an evening of holiday cheer at the Ames ISU Arena last Sunday night. It was the club's annual holiday event, featuring performances from skaters of all ages. Saturday's paper reported that the Iowa Health Department had announced the Omicron variant of the coronavirus had come to the state. The case involved an Iowa resident under the age of 18 who had travel exposure. That person has not been identified and was said to have no symptoms of the virus and was in isolation. The person lives in Black Hawk County. The state's interim health director said the appearance of the virus in Iowa was no surprise, that every state around Iowa had a case. The Trib also reported that books being read by children in central Iowa schools have recently been challenged by politicians and parents. Such challenges have taken place in the Ankeny, Johnston, Urbandale, Waukee, and West Des Moines school districts. Those books often feature stories about LGBTQ people and people of color. Parents challenging those books say they are obscene or even pornographic, and that they are not appropriate for children. Politicians have called for criminal penalties for educators who make such materials available to students. But students and librarians say students can be trusted to make decisions for themselves, and that in some cases, the material has proved critical to students' understanding of who they are in the world. And Saturday's Trib had a list of where you can find Christmas light displays and other festive activities this holiday season. Among the places, Center Grove Orchard in Cambridge, Ryman Gardens in Ames, and the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad, which is running its Santa Express. Sunday's Trib reported that Iowa farmers are paying top prices for the state's used farm equipment. Supply chain disruptions are hitting all equipment makers, and everything's been complicated by the recently ended 5-week strike against the John Deere Company by the United Auto Workers Union. That's all worked together to restrict supplies, at the same time that abundant harvests and high prices are putting cash in farmers' hands and driving up demand. Experts say the used farm equipment market rivals the years 2012-2013, when a widespread drought drove corn and soybean prices to new highs, and U.S. farm income hit a record $143 billion. And now, farm equipment that is 5 or 10 years old is often selling for more than it did when it was new. There was also a report about a program that the Tyson Food Processing Company has had for more than 2 decades, partnering with Hawkeye Community College in Cedar Falls to provide hands-on training for Tyson employees to work on the company's production lines. Starting salary for graduates of the Industrial Maintenance Training Program is $68,000 a year. When they graduate, a variety of jobs are available for them at Tyson, including computer technicians, mechanics, supervisors, and more. There was also word that Iowa school districts are trying to diversify the ranks of teachers. The percentage of teachers of color in Iowa has remained nearly stagnant in the past 2 decades, from less than 2% of the workforce of K-12 public teachers in the year 2000 to less than 3% this year. During that time, enrollment of students of color in the state has risen from about 10% to 26%. Tuesday's paper reported on some of what this year's Des Moines Register poll showed about what Iowans are thinking and feeling. Among the results, Governor Kim Reynolds will enter next year, when she likely will seek re-election, in a strong position. The poll shows most Iowans support her. The poll also shows President Biden is in a difficult position here in Iowa. The most recent survey shows his job approval rating here is down to 31%, with 62% of Iowans disapproving of what he's doing. That same poll shows former President Trump defeating Biden by 11 percentage points if the presidential election were held today. The Trib also reported that Iowa Farm Bureau Federation members had elected Brad Johnson to lead the agricultural group, this after the retirement of its longtime president, Craig Hill. Johnson farms near Manson in the northwest part of the state. He's the Farm Bureau's 14th board president. Hill was president for 10 years and has been involved in Farm Bureau leadership for 40 years. And the Trib reported that Iowa deer hunters had found a dead mountain lion with a broken snare around its neck in Poweshiek County. Mountain lions have no legal wildlife status in Iowa, so the hunters could have kept the carcass. But they voluntarily turned over the 119-pound male cat to the Department of Natural Resources. The DNR will do testing to potentially determine the lion's background, age, and overall health. Wednesday's Trib reported that the Ames School District Board had voted to end its school resource officer program starting next fall. That means officers will no longer patrol the city's middle and high school. The school board vote to end the program was unanimous after years of community discussion over how the presence of police impacts students. The original intent of the resource officer program was for police to build relationships with those students. But as Ames schools have dealt with more fights and student behavioral issues this year, administrators have increasingly called on officers to get involved in those situations. There was also word that Story County supervisors had voted to condemn the possible use of eminent domain for 2 pipelines proposed to cut through Iowa. The 2 carbon containment pipelines are proposed to break ground in an effort to lower emissions. Farmers argued that the damage to their land would result in years of crop yield losses. The county supervisors also approved the first reading of an ordinance that could allow non-commercial livestock on residential property. In recent years, more people in urban and suburban areas have opened their yards to barnyard pets, including chickens and goats. Several counties in Iowa already allow chickens, rabbits, and bees on residential properties. If the supervisors eventually pass the proposed ordinance, residents could keep 1 small animal, poultry, fowl, rabbits, and other similar animals, per 1,500 square feet of property. Roosters would be prohibited. Residents could keep 1 animal, such as sheep, swine, and goats, per 5,000 square feet. Yesterday's paper reported that 2 Ames City Council members will wind up in new wards because of a new city redistricting map. Ward 4 Councilmember Rachel Junk will be in the Ward 1 district, and current Ward 1 Councilmember Gloria Betcher will be in Ward 3, along with current Ward 3 Councilmember-elect Anita Rollins. Iowa law requires an election 2 years after redistricting if multiple council members fall into the same ward. The Trib also reported that several city council members had expressed concerns over the decision by the Ames School District Board to end the school resource officer program next fall. Councilmember Amber Corrieri said that decision came after statistics involving the program had been cherry-picked and after misguided agendas were allowed to influence decisions. Councilmembers Gloria Betcher and Tim Garten supported her comments. There was also word that the Boone Board of Education had voted this week to end the mask requirement mandate for students in grades pre-K through 8th grade. That requirement will end December 22nd. And the Trib had word that Iowa farmland values had skyrocketed 29% this past year, averaging more than $9,700 an acre. That's the highest in 80 years before adjusting for inflation. And that is your summary of quite a week of news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart, taking a deep breath now and planning to come right back into the same virtual seat on Monday when I'll have word on what's been making news around Iowa. Until then, why don't we both have a great weekend?
Never knew.
you, Dennis Hart, with your Week in the News, and the music interlude was Planet Requiem, a piece from our next guest, Steve Vasey. Steve, welcome to Local Talk.
Thank you.
So I hear your name associated with everything important concerning water quality in Iowa. So before we get started on a very important topic concerning an outstanding water in Northeast Iowa called Bloody Run, what is your background, Steve?
Well, I've lived in Iowa for 45 years. I'm originally from New Brunswick in Canada. I worked at Iowa State University for over 40 years, basically managing a chemical instrumentation facility. So I have a background in chemistry. I've been involved in water quality issues as a volunteer for about 25 years.
Well, that kind of brings to mind, I think we met maybe 30 years ago during an Iowa water gathering, and you were involved with water quality. That was kind of a citizen scientist approach to monitoring water quality here in the state. Do you know what happened to that Iowa water program?
Well, 4 or 5 years ago, I believe the legislature kind of disbanded it or defunded it. So it basically went away. It's been lost to us.
I might even point out that there was an AmeriCorps member back in the day, Rich Leopold, was even hired to be the Iowa Water Coordinator and then became the director of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources years later in a second life. And now that whole program has been disbanded.
Yes. So what we've done now is there is a program that the Isaac Walton League offers called Save Our Streams. And that's one of the longest running volunteer monitoring programs in the country. So many people have switched over and are now still monitoring as part of the SOS program. And in fact, the volunteers that monitored up in Bloody Run Creek up in that area, we are all SOS certified volunteers.
Certified volunteers. Okay. Well, that's significant. And so you have been testing the water. This Bloody Run Creek, as I refer to it, as an outstanding Iowa water in Northeast Iowa, we refer to affectionately as the Driftless area that has a lot of karst topography. So there's a lot of limestone in the geology of that area and a lot of permeability, I guess you would say, for lack of a better word, on with water, surface water going from the agriculture lands into those waterways. And how long have you been familiar with the Bloody Creek trout stream?
Well, I think I first fished Bloody Run Creek almost 30 years ago. I'm with the Hawkeye Fly Fishing Association also. We do a lot of stream improvement projects, and I believe we did a stream improvement project on Bloody Run Creek many, many years ago, so far in the past that I forget the actual date.
Sure. Well,
So I've been fishing it quite regularly in the past few years. Of course, the current controversy started in 2017. And Bloody Run Creek, as you mentioned, is an outstanding Iowa water, which has a very special meaning for me because that's a category of waters that I worked for almost a decade along with other people to establish in Iowa back in the day when we believed that Iowa was not properly implementing the Federal Clean Water Act and requirements for something called anti-degradation. And as a result of a couple of lawsuits and a lot of hard work, we eventually were able to establish this category called Outstanding Iowa Waters, which has been required for many, many years, but the state just hadn't done it. And then we were able to get 32 cold water trout streams as well as some of the Okoboji lakes into that category. And those waters are deserving of special protection. So Bloody Run Creek has a special place in my heart.
Are there provisions specifically designed to protect those waters that are being overlooked, or are they being implemented, or where are we at with what it takes?
Well, as with most things in our Iowa code and Iowa laws, we have a fairly good handle on what's called your traditional point source dischargers like wastewater treatment plants, cities, industries. We have much less control over agricultural interests, but this particular situation, Supreme Beef, they are, under the Federal Clean Water Act, they are a point source discharger unless they claim they are not, which is a funny way to look at things, but that's the way the law is. So they're presumed to be a point source discharger because they're so large.
How large is this facility?
This facility is 11,600 cattle. Now, that puts it in the top 1% of all cattle operations in Iowa in terms of size. So it's huge. Typical operations up in northeast Iowa might be 500 cattle. 1,000 cattle would be considered really large in that area. And this one is 11,600. So it's so large that it is presumed to be a discharger unless it claims not to. They have claimed that they will never discharge. Well, we don't believe that's true.
What is some of your preliminary water testing indicating?
We have done volunteer testing at about 20 sites up in that area, not only Bloody Run watershed, but some of the other watersheds in the area where manure is scheduled to be applied from the facility. And then we did grab samples at 12 sites after rain events this fall, after two specific rain events. We partnered with the University of Iowa State Hygienic Lab. They analyzed the samples for us. They provided the collection vials. And we used their protocol to basically grab samples, drive them to Iowa City, and have them tested for both bacteria levels and ammonia levels. And we, in fact, found a number of sites where there was very elevated, I'm talking about really high, bacteria levels and detectable ammonia. Those things taken together are, as a scientist, I consider to be a strong indication that there's manure in the water. And I don't think I'm the only person who believes that by any means. And the sites we were monitoring were chosen specifically because they would be sites where manure discharges from the Supreme Beef approved application fields would show up. Mm-hmm. So
is that the end of waterways or where small tributaries?
Basically, it's where small tributaries are at the bottom of where fields come together and drain. And we sampled primarily at bridge crossings and road culverts, so we weren't trespassing on anybody's property. We also sampled at various sites on Bloody Run Creek as well. So the volunteers did a really good job. We did, as I mentioned, detect bacteria and ammonia at a number of sites. We've sent that information to the Field Office 1 in Manchester. That's DNR Field Office 1 in Manchester. We lodged what's called a complaint to ask them to investigate. It's a simple situation. We can't say at this time that it's manure from Supreme Beef that ended up in the water, but only DNR can look at the manure application rates and the manure application sites from a facility. And if they do that, and if they find that, yes, you're right, there was a bunch of manure spread on that field just a few days before you sampled and detected manure in the water, well, that's a smoking gun, isn't it?
Steve, Mike Metz here. A question. I mean, perhaps you don't know this answer, but what are the requirements for a field that's acceptable for application, especially in a topography that is karst, which is known to not only leach into the surface water, but down into the aquifer of that area? Do you have any handle on that?
Well, if the facility is required to have either a manure management plan or a nutrient management plan, and this facility is required to have a nutrient management plan, then manure can only be applied at what's called agronomic rates, where the nutrient that they're basing it on is typically the nitrogen in the manure, not the phosphorus. If phosphorus levels are high, that sometimes can be a limiting factor as well. Now, What we claim in our litigation against DNR is that when they approved the nutrient management plan submitted by the producer, there were a lot of errors and flaws and miscalculations in the plan that basically the plan allows the producer to apply at what we believe is four times as much nitrogen as is agronomically necessary and six times as much phosphorus as is agronomically necessary. And so those applications will really, really over-apply manure and manure nutrients to those highly erodible land fields, HEL categorized fields that drain down into tributaries that all flow into cold water streams.
Well, you mentioned litigation, so I'm curious, what is the status of the 11,600 head feedlot facility at this time? Have they started bringing in the livestock?
We believe they have started bringing livestock in. We're not sure if the livestock is coming into the exist. There was one existing barn at the site that had a capacity of 800, and then they built the six additional ones to increase the capacity to 11,600. So those new barns, they're like two football fields long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the funniest thing is they call these things, they categorize them as open feedlots. And that probably brings a picture to mind of, you know, cows outside running around in some enclosed area. And that's not what it is at all. All of these cows, they're inside what are essentially confinement buildings. They'll never be outside those buildings. But because they are in Iowa code, it is still defined as an open feedlot. They were not required to have any construction permit for the facility or any public review of the facility. For example, if this was categorized as a confinement, it would have been covered under what's called the master matrix, which I'm sure your folks all know about, and would have been subject to a county scrutiny of some sort. But because of the loophole they've taken advantage of in the law, there's been no environmental review whatsoever. The consequences of this huge cattle feedlot.
Well, we've got a few more minutes. What would be your advice, the take-home message then? You mentioned the litigation, I believe. And I might point out that KHOI has covered this story relatively since the start, since 2017. And we've had Wally Taylor, attorney with Sierra Club, and Larry Stone and Rick Zarwell, and some pretty key individuals, environmentally speaking, as yourself. So what is the public responsibility now?
Well, I think there's two areas. One is we have litigation. The first hearing is on January 6th. Of course, DNR filed a motion to dismiss, and we've rebutted that, and that hearing is on January 6th. So folks who are interested could go to our website, SaveBloodyRun.org, or our Facebook page, SaveBloodyRun, and get all the information about the litigation, how they could join in and participate at that hearing on January 6th. Of course, we're trying to raise money to support our efforts, and so also at our Facebook page and our website, SaveBloodyRun.org, there's opportunities to contribute. The other thing people should know is this is all political. There's been political interference in this process since the inception in 2017, and particularly since the stormwater permit was approved in the summer of 2017. We've always wondered why DNR would go so far out on a limb in approving this facility and kind of bend over backwards, and we would say, actually, outside the bounds of their authority, to allow this particular facility to go in there. And it was always a question, why? Well, the more we dig into it, the more we understand that there's a political connection between the owner, one of the owners of Supreme Beef, and a senator, a very influential senator in the Iowa Senate. And this senator's fingerprints are all over this process, by the way. We've seen it in the approval of a stormwater plan. We've seen it in approval of an NM nutrient management plan. So people should be upset that our Department of Natural Resources, which is tasked with protecting the environment, is actually under the sway of politicians when it comes to something as serious as protecting our natural resources.
Okay. We've been listening to Steve Vasey with the Coldwater Alliance and a spokesperson for the Save Bloody Run campaign. And we certainly appreciate your time today and this unfolding story, Mr. Vasey, and hope you can join us again as new developments materialize.
Well, thank you so much.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and I'm your host, Pat Schlarbaum, with co-host Mike Metz and engineer Mike Murphy. Let's welcome Susan Gwiazda, Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. Hello, Susan.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good to be here.
Great to have you with us once again. Any developments you'd like to announce before we introduce your guest?
Well, I will tell you, it has not seemed very winter-like lately, and Justin can give our guest today is our Public Works Operations Manager, Justin Claussen, who is very active in our recent, very unusual December weather. Mm-hmm. Usually Justin's on at this time of year talking about snow and snowfall and how to prepare for winter, but we had a little blip this week, mm-hmm. and wasn't as bad as we anticipated, although it was statewide. A pretty unusual weather event, and so we are doing some cleanup, and departments are busy. Just in general, things for December, as I keep reminding, we'll have our final city council meeting of the year on December 21st, which is the city council workshop regarding climate action mm-hmm. planning, and then the council will be on recess basically until our first January meeting. Mm-hmm. So city offices are closed the Thursday and Friday before Christmas, the 23rd and 24th. And then we'll also be closed on Friday, December 31st for New Year's.
Okay, that makes sense. And a real important meeting, December 21st, at the city council and reviewing the climate action plan. Sustainability.
Exactly.
Adaptations to what the city can
right.
do. Yeah. Well, Justin Claussen, welcome to Local Talk.
Morning, Pat.
Yeah, and as Susan kind of mentioned, we're not talking snow, but more cleanup.
Yeah, you know, it was definitely an interesting early part of this week. I told some others about this, that when the National Weather Service forecasters are using the terms unprecedented and historic and extreme, I don't like that. and no one should like that, but it just gives you pause that we have 70 plus degrees and then, you know, wind gusts that are forecasted to be above 80 miles per hour coming in through here. There was no playbook for this. There's no other event that we could compare this to. The National Weather Service would say the same. So we were learning as we were going along too. We had activated our incident command center just in advance, you know, trying to think mm-hmm. back of what did we learn from the derecho in August.
Yeah, up 2020.
You know, we did. Yes, exactly. We did not have advance notice of that. Really, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. maybe about 90 minutes at most. Here, we knew it was forecast for a couple of days.
And wasn't that forecast?
We were in there.
Wasn't that amazing that they could forecast it in advance so well, so predictably?
Yes, and it's such a wide swath too this time. That's I can't tell people enough how helpful that is, just to even have a little bit of a heads up. I mean, we had generators fueled up, we had things ready to go, you know, the power plant was working, stuff being staged, and you know, we learned some lessons and we were trying to prepare for them. And thankfully, we fared rather well compared to some other communities. And I think as a state overall, it could have been a lot worse. But Ames definitely turned out okay. And not a lot of damage, a few trees here or there. But overall, we came through it.
I wonder if we benefited from the impacts of the derecho in 2020, in that a lot of the suspect trees or hollow trees, or that was all eliminated previously.
I think so.
So now we kind of went through another brunt, and thankfully, it wasn't as.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think the derecho took out a lot of the weaker trees, so it spared us a little bit this time. And the winds were not as bad for as long, but we also had no foliage on the trees too. That helps not having the vegetation to grab.
Oh,
that
good
wind.
Point. Yeah,
that was a big deal as well. So I think both those kind of played in our favor.
Well, you had a really good lead in, and as you say, wasn't any playbook, but you did make it through. And just how dramatic was it in the end? I was okay out in the country.
Yeah, you know, during that night, I was, like I said, I was in the incident command center.
Sure.
Until about 8 o'clock that night, and we had two calls about trees that were down. So we went and took care of those during that time frame. There were two power outages, but they were both restored within about an hour's time at most. And really, the delay on some of those was we were just waiting for the winds to die down a little bit for the safety of the crews.
Sure.
Once those mm-hmm. did, we were able to jump on them pretty quickly. But, you know, we didn't get a chance to look at stuff until it was Thursday morning, because it was dark and it was night when it came out. And mm-hmm. really, you know, our initial sweep, just using, you know, police officers and information for the public, was there wasn't much damage. And even after that, there's a few trees here and there, but nothing significant of any means. It's all individual trees in spotty locations. Mm-hmm. So just kind of luck of the draw, I'd say.
Well, thank goodness for that. Did you happen to notice the smell, the aroma of things,
yeah.
things burning, which was kind of like, oh, my goodness, what's going on here? And I understand that was from maybe smoke from Kansas.
That's my understanding. I shared that I went home about 8 o'clock, and then about 8:30 I heard something banging outside my house, and I didn't know what it was. I thought, well, I better go find out my siding rip off or something. I stepped outside, and you could smell that clear as day. I actually texted our fire chief and said, I don't know if there's a fire in town, but this is pretty strong. And said their crews were actually out looking a little bit during that time because of the just the odor was so strong. Thankfully, it wasn't anything here, but it's just amazing how far that smell can carry.
I guess just another indication of, and everyone was on high alert from the previous night of tornadoes that ravaged southern states and Tennessee and Kentucky, and my goodness. I guess it sounds like you were prepared, and that is reassuring always. But
so,
you guys.
So, Pat, if I could jump in for just a minute.
Yeah.
We did do an assessment yesterday morning on the power outage. While other cities had thousands of people out of power, we ended up with 589 over the course of the evening. There was some residual wind whipping branches into trees. So we had about five or mm-hmm. six small outages, two that occurred, like Justin said, right during the peak of the wind, and then several more throughout the night. Not one of those was out longer than 2 hours, 40 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
So we were able to get crews out and mm-hmm. get those people repowered very quickly. And that had been some of our early messaging, was that if your power is out, please be prepared for a long outage, because we don't know when we can get to you.
Yeah.
A lot of the equipment that we use to restore power cannot be brought out in weather like this. So we were really pleased at the end that really nobody was out that long, and that the outages were fairly minor. I mean, it's never fun to be without your electricity, but 2 hours, 40 minutes was the longest.
I would just really like to point out that, and to reference back to the derecho, I mean, it was days and days of hard labor, and yet it seemed to introduce a new perspective on looking at our urban forest. And you know, we've had our urban forester on, and there's been a lot of work done to ensure that another derecho impact or a wind like this. And so when it turned out not quite as critical as it might have been, then I think Paul Talke and your staff, you guys can really take some credit here for having our urban canopy in such that it didn't devastate the electric lines like it did during the derecho.
Yeah, I know Paul and his staff spent a lot of time doing exactly what you said there, looking at the canopy, looking at places where we have some weaker trees or some trees that are mm-hmm. not structurally as sound as they need to be, and thinning those as best they can. And while sometimes it can be visually, not the aesthetic that people like, there's also that safety standpoint of it where they can get to it early so it doesn't cause a problem later on.
Yeah, Mr. Talke, really, I think somebody can take some credit here. And let's start with him. Okay.
Yes.
Well, I think Justin was the one that actually started our urban ash removal plan. And then Paul just took it and went with it.
Yeah.
This idea of getting out trees that could be problematic and then replanting. And that's all part of the plan, is to replace and diversify.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Justin Claussen. Yeah, absolutely.
You're welcome.
Well, so we are going to get ready for snow. Why not? It's going to be here. Do you have any words of advice, or what can we do about the pending winter that it will arrive? It is Iowa.
It always does. You're correct. Yeah. So we transition quickly, but it always goes to winter. And so the biggest things I want people to remember that can help us as a city and as a department is to make sure that know where you park as far as snow routes go. Mm-hmm. Those red and white signs on your streets. If you don't know, you can contact Public Works and we can certainly look at it and let you know one way or the other. But the big thing is if you can remove those vehicles anytime it snows, but particularly during snow ordinances. We look at snow ordinances when we get 2 inches or more of snow. We usually put notice out that those are happening well in advance so people have time to move their vehicles. But getting off of a snow route, pulling into a driveway is the most preferable. If you can't, then parking on another side street that is not a designated snow route. That helps us clear those routes efficiently and quickly, helps us get emergency vehicles where they need to go if they need to go there. And, we can get through the town quicker that way. We can, get rid of the inconvenience of snow that happens on our transportation system. So that's the biggest thing I'd ask people to look for is know where you park, know those snow routes, pay attention to the weather. There are times where we may not put a snow ordinance into effect. We think we're only going to get a half inch of snow, and then we end up with three. And that's caught us before. And sometimes, forecasts are only as good as a piece of paper they're written on at times. So we try to do our best, but anything people can do to move vehicles or any obstruction that's on the road helps us get the job done quicker.
Well, I don't know how many drivers you do have, but a lot of times when a storm is being forecast, and I think, get ready to throw another log on the fire and we'll hunker down. But you have staff that when they see those forecasts, they know they're going to have to be engaged, and they don't get to kick back. So let's think about those snowplow drivers and just make their work that much more expedient, and so your staff can do their prescribed activities, responsibilities, and we'll all just benefit from that. And thanks for all those guys and women that take to the trucks and keep our streets safe.
Yeah, it's a great message because sometimes you can humanize that message too. That these are individuals that have families too. When it snows on Christmas and it's beautiful, and we all love that too. But at the end of the day, they leave their families to go to work, and when they get done, they go home to scoop their own driveway too. Okay. They work long hours for that. So that's something that they work hard for. So whatever we can do to help them get home too is another way to think about that.
Well, I really want to thank you for this time and wish you Merry Christmas, Susan and Justin. You bet. And thanks for coming on Local Talk. Thanks for another banner year of 2021 with really timely advice and stories. And you guys just do a great job. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Pat.
Thanks for having us, Pat.
Have a good weekend. Susan Guiazda, Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames, and Justin Claussen, our Maintenance Supervisor. Let's welcome Michaela Vanderberg, Iowa State University Extension, Agriculture and Natural Resources Program Coordinator. Hi, Michaela.
Absolutely. How are you guys?
Well, it's great to have you with us with Mike Metz here and Mike Murphy and in the studios. Thank you for appearing on Zoom. And tell us about your upcoming activities this winter season.
Yes. So in my role, I get the awesome opportunity to include horticulture under my umbrella title. And we have a lot of fun webinars and presentations coming up this spring held at our county office. Our most recent one is a planting design series. So that'll be planting design tips, so learning how to arrange plants in your garden, planting design models, so arranging all of those things, and then planting design graphics, putting it on paper, all of those really pretty graphics that landscape designers create. You'll learn how to make those as well at this most recent or most upcoming program.
Yeah. And that's going to be a workshop?
It is going to be a presentation from a specialist at Iowa State University. We are inviting folks to come to our office for snacks and mingling to watch this presentation to learn about these topics.
And when is that?
Yes. So the first one in the series is January 4th from 6 to 7 p.m. The second session of the three-part session is January 11th, and that third session is January 18th. Those are Tuesday nights. And if you're interested in those, just give us a call. We'll get you on our list. You do have limited space for that session.
Okay, let's go ahead with your phone number now, and then I'll include it at the website.
Wonderful. So our phone number is 515-337-1601. And you can also check this out on our website, which is www.extension.iastate.edu/story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I'll try to remember to repeat that, but it will be on our website. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so that's just the first one of the season this spring. We'll have many more coming up in relation to houseplant propagation, seed starting, coming up later in the spring, probably closer to May, we're going to have a flower arranging workshop, things like that. So be looking for more details on those. Our office is also offering a lot of other programming for adults and youth. One of our big ones that's coming up is the Mindful Teen, and that's for youth in grades 7 through 12. And it's a 6-session series that to teach kids about practical strategies for managing stress and difficult emotions and helping them improve their overall well-being in relationships and sports and school, all kind of a full circle program here. And this starts in January 27th, and it'll be Thursdays from 5:30 to 7 through March 3rd. There is space limited for this group. So if you are interested in that, reach out to our office, and we will get you in the right direction to get signed up for that.
Okay. And that's starting January 27th. Mindful Teens.
Yep.
I like that.
Absolutely. I think it's a great program to help kids really learn. Their big topic is stress and learning how to manage stress. I think that's a really important skill for high schoolers to learn.
I'm kind of thinking of your extension, mandate or, kind of your mission. And how that is, really seems like it's grown to strengthen the family and in all activities that surround the natural resources and the environment, of course, but what a great extension for that. How many years has that program been?
This, I believe, is its second year. It's a relatively new developed program, but we have had such great feedback from it. This past fall, our coordinator did this in the Colonesco School for all of their seventh graders. And so it was then very well received. And so we're just going to try it again and offer it to even more kids.
Oh, well, wonderful. That's very interesting. Your mission is growing.
Yes, absolutely. And then for some of our younger kids, if you're not in grades 7 through 12, all school-age youth are welcome to come to our Maker Mondays. This is the third Monday of the month from 6:30 to 7:30, at our office. And like I said, for all school-age youth, and they will design and create and make things as they relate to science and energy and physics with a new theme each month. This, again, is a free event for any school-age youth. We just ask that you give our office a call and let us know you're coming so we make sure we have enough supplies for everyone.
Well, that's very interesting. Also, does that have spill over into the 4-H Club? Would those projects possibly, go through the county fair system?
Absolutely. So this is kind of like that introductory to our club type system. You don't necessarily have to be a 4-H Club member to come to this event. However, it is very, very similar to our club system. Mm-hmm. And if that's something that this interested you, got your interest going, you could definitely join a club and take one of these things that you made to the county fair.
Yeah, so I guess, for lack of a better term, ISU Extension is performing the role of the mothership. And then then the different 4-H chapters, and if so you wouldn't necessarily have to be a member of 4-H, it sounds like, but it does kind of match up well with some of their activities that grow into the county fair and the state fair.
Absolutely. And so if you were interested in joining that 4-H program, which is for youth in grades 4 through 12, that enrollment is open until February 1st, and that opens you up to learning about all sorts of different topics and projects and programs. There's not enough time in the day to talk about all of them. Mm-hmm. If there's something that interests you, there's probably a project in 4-H that correlates perfectly with it, mm-hmm. And then you could take that learning experience as a project to the county fair.
Yeah, that's good to know, and I really like this format, if you will, where you give people an idea of many different activities. You're very busy people, apparently, and this outreach is just tremendous.
Absolutely. And like I said,
so we got a couple more minutes.
So. We have a bunch of other programs. This is just the highlight of the few that are coming up really soon. We will have our program catalog that will list all of our programs we are offering for youth and adults from January through July. That will be coming out between Christmas and New Year's. So be looking for that. We will have hard copies that you can pick up at your local library or at our county office. And this will also be listed on our homepage of our website, which again is www.extension.iastate.edu/story. So all of our programs are listed there in a list by town and also as a calendar format. So however you would like to look at that.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Michaela Vanderberg, ISU Extension Agriculture and Natural Resource Program Coordinator. Have a good weekend. Merry Christmas.
Yes, thank you, Pat. Have a nice weekend.
Okay, we'll see you again in January. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. every weekday since the pandemic started in March of 2020 at 89.1 FM. We're no longer rebroadcasting at 5 p.m., so you'll be able to pick up this program from the archives on our website, khoifm.org. And while you're at that website, please remember to support this station financially at khoifm.org and find the yellow donate button.
KHOI provides a platform for citizens and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media.
Thank you, Local Talk producer Lynn Carey, and thank you, Dennis Hart, with your Friday report. Thank you, engineer Mike Murphy, and thanks to our guests, Steve Vasey, Susan Guiasta, Justin Clausen, and Michaela Vanderberg with ISU Extension. Thank you, co-host Mike Metz. This is Pat Schlarbaum.
And our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other artists you heard was Steve Vasey, Planet Requiem, and Big Blue Sky, River I Know. Stay tuned for headline news and Democracy Now! And Adagio at 9 a.m. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
FM Story City, Ames, and this is Joshua Rudenberg from Minneapolis.
Hello, Iowa.